Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Out to the moon, come out there.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't, lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cat. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this, because it remains the property of the client. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness, because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technicians, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Because it's cold, the beer tastes better, and so I get more customers.
All right. February 1st, 2022. And We want to keep our energy and vibes up because we do not want to forget about those New Year's resolutions, goals, whatever you call them, that we put into motion last month. Now, typically here in the United States, what is observed is Black History Month. Well, here at It's My House, we do a twist on that. And we're introducing Slave Entrepreneur Month. Slave Entrepreneur Month. And what we shall be doing for every live stream, and we'll be doing 20 this month, at least 20, one a day, Monday through Friday, we'll be talking primarily about slave people who started off life as a slave and became an entrepreneur, a business owner. And some became wealthy entrepreneurs. So with that in mind, today's podcast is titled Slave Entrepreneurs and Social Entrepreneurship. Now, many of these slaves that became wealthy, they were, I would call, but in today's terms, I would call them social entrepreneurs, because they started basically social enterprises or things linked to social enterprises. And they were able to earn money to buy off the contract, you know, the pay off master or whatever, you know, whatever arrangements they had with him or her. And they were able to buy their freedom. And the social entrepreneurship comes in where some of them also bought the freedom of other family members. They were social entrepreneurs. Anyway, so let's get in. We do one a day. Today we're going to cover a person I've covered on here before, but we're going to start off with one. She goes under my classification of slave entrepreneur, although she was a social entrepreneur, and we'll break it down. And it's Priscilla Baltimore. And most of the stuff I'm going to tell you about this entire month, you can find it right online. Priscilla, also known as Mother Baltimore, born May 13th, 1801. That was her sunrise, sunset, November 28th, 1882. All right. She lived to be 81. She was an abolitionist and a social worker. She adopted children, and she assisted former slaves. That's where that social entrepreneurship comes in at. She's also known as the founder of Brooklyn, Illinois. And Brooklyn, Illinois, properly known as Lovejoy, Illinois, is a village in St. Clair County, Illinois, located 2 miles north of the East St. Louis, Illinois. Let's see, let's go to history. All right, according to oral history and tradition, by 1829, Mother Priscilla Baltimore led a group of 11 families composed of both fugitive and free African Americans to flee slavery in St. Louis, Missouri. They crossed the Mississippi River to the free state of Illinois, where they established a freedom village in the American Bottoms. Mother Baltimore was said to have purchased her freedom as an adult from her master. She also bought the freedom of members of her family. Now, that's social entrepreneurship. Now some of you people are thinking, well, how did she get the money together? Because these were slaves. Well, just because they were slaves didn't mean they were not allowed to participate in the free enterprise system of the United States. And many slaves, like Mother Priscilla Baltimore, they were artisans. What is an artisan? An artisan typically is a craftsperson that, you know, they're good at making things. They could be good at making bricks, masonry. They could be good at carpentry. They could be good back then making horseshoes, saddles, or being a seamstress, making clothes. So these artisans, which many of these slaves were, many of these slaves were artisans. They made things and they sold them. And that's how they were able to collect enough money, just like Mother Priscilla Baltimore did, and she was able to buy her freedom as well as the freedom of others. Now, let's lump this into social entrepreneurship. Social entrepreneurship, there's many ways that we can approach it. Social entrepreneurship identifies a social need that might not be met by the government or anybody else, and they start a business based on that social need. Now, what Mother Priscilla Baltimore did, and let me read it again. Okay. Once again, according to oral history and tradition, by 1829, Mother Priscilla Baltimore led a group of 11 families composed of both fugitive slaves and free Americans, African Americans, to flee the slavery in St. Louis, Missouri. That was a social issue. Back then, in 1829, that was a serious social issue. Even if you were a free person, free slave, you're a former slave, you're freed. Being in St. Louis, Missouri at that time was not all of a good place to be. So using her artisan skills, Priscilla Baltimore, once again, was able to purchase her freedom. And she got together with, as I just read it, 11 other families. And they took their money that they earned as artisans and bought some land. Let's see. Today, Brooklyn, Illinois has a population of probably 749 people, and the total land mass of it is 0.01 square miles. So it's not a big place at all. Matter of fact, let's see. Let's convert this. Square miles into acres. Okay. All right. 1 square mile is 640 acres. So they didn't have that many. Let's see what we can come up with here. Okay. All right, convert from square miles to acres. Okay, 0.81. Hold on, I don't know if this got, all right. There we go. 0.81 square miles to acres is 518.4 acres. And they started the town of Brooklyn, Illinois. Now, that's what it is today. They might have started off with a smaller number, but This is according to, what do you call it, Wikipedia. All right, now, well, hold it now. Where, or here, anyway. So, let's see. All right. So, mother, Priscilla Baltimore purchased the freedom of members of her family. Born in Kentucky, she tracked down her white father to Missouri and bought her mother's freedom from him. So, oh boy, all right, she's courageous. The earliest black families included Andersons, Sullivan, Singleton, Wilson, Cox, Wyatt, and Carper families. Miranda Yancey Bailey, an archaeologist working on the 21st Century Project in Brooklyn, Illinois, has found written evidence that Baltimore still lived in St. Louis in the 1830s. The first documentation of her associated with Brooklyn, Illinois, is from 1839. She may have been traveling between the locations for a time. Baltimore had become a Methodist preacher. Boy, she wore a lot of hats. And participated in the religious life of the new settlement, which is now known as Brooklyn, Illinois. William Paul Quinn, then a missionary of the newly founded AME, or African Methodist Episcopal Church, visited the settlement in 1836 and helped found the Brooklyn AME Church that year. He had been assigned a missionary that year, what was then called the Northwest, including Indiana and Ohio. Okay, Priscilla Baltimore built a house in which she occupied in from 1851 to 1872. In the 1840s and the 1850s, the African-American population in the village was about 200 people. And once again, when it comes to social entrepreneurship, you can pick various different social projects, but in this case, in today's terminology, the project that Mother Priscilla Baltimore and her family, 11 families, got together and put together was their social project was a community project, and that community project was to found a freedom village. And this Freedom Village is called Brooklyn, Illinois today. All right. On July 8th, 1873, Brooklyn was incorporated. By 1886, the population included 371 African Americans and 302 European Americans or residents. By the 19th century, the residents joined in taking new industrial drives, commuting to those in East St. Louis and nearby areas. Blacks who migrated migrated to what became known as Brooklyn was attracted to the possibilities of working in an industrialized settlement that would enjoy race autonomy and self-determination. In 1886, the African-American majority worked to register voters and gain political control of the village. As with most political enterprises, fractions developed within the community. Regional capital investment largely bypassed Brooklyn, taking place in the competing East St. Louis, Illinois, which gained an all-important railroad connection. Other white majority towns that benefited from being in a network of investment, almost none of the all-black towns obtained a railroad. A small village became all-black. Let's see. In 1891, Mayor Evans dedicated the town's new post office with the name Lovejoy after the abolitionist Elijah P. Lovejoy, who had been assassinated in Alton, Illinois in 1837. I'm skipping through a lot of this. Okay. Okay, according to the 2010 census, Brooklyn, Illinois has a total area of 0.83, and I had it at 0.81, so let me go back and correct this. Today it's consisting of 531.2 acres. So, hey, man, now I don't know if it started out like that. There's another entrepreneur, slave entrepreneur, that a formerly slave entrepreneur, because once again, this is Slave Entrepreneur Month. We're featuring people all this month that started off life as a slave, but got into entrepreneurship, and some became wealthy. So Mother Priscilla Baltimore, in today's terms, she was a social entrepreneur, and she was an artisan. I'm sure you had artisans among the other 11 families that came with her, and they put their money together, and they bought land, and they started what is called a Freedom Village. That Freedom Village today is known as Brooklyn, Illinois. And what's interesting about this is, now she did this with no internet connection, no smartphone, no cable TV, no government programs. And they were lynching people back then too, but they did their research, and they set up shop, and a lot of things that they did then we can still do today. Now Brooklyn, Illinois, is a municipality. And there are at least 19,500 municipalities in the United States as I speak. Most of those places, now a municipality is an incorporated, a place that's been incorporated, has a municipal charter. Most towns, most of these 19,500 municipalities that exist today did not start out with a corporate charter. It all started typically by one, maybe sometimes two or three people, in this case, Mother Priscilla Baltimore, the founder of Brooklyn, Illinois. Her and 11 people, they got together and they founded the town. They bought the land. That's how it started. I doubt if they had 500 acres to start. I don't know. I had to do more research on that. But, you know, some people, well, like I say, we're covering one a day because I don't want to give away everything. Anyway, Freedom. Let me see if I can find some information on that for you guys. Essentially, Freedom Villages. And there was several of them. Let me see if I can find it this way. These were, sorry, here we go. And let me correct this so you guys can check up on me. Freedmen's Towns, that's spelled F-R-E-E-D-M-E-N-S, one word, I mean M-E-N, one word. Freedmen's Towns. I was born in Freedmen's Hospital in D.C. Let me read about that. Okay, and this is a lot of your slave entrepreneurs. Okay, they embarked upon social enterprises known as Freedmen's Towns. Let me give you some backdrop on that. Historically, a Freedmen's Town is an African-American municipality known in various areas as Freedmen's Town, Freedmen's Towns, or Freedom Town, or all black towns, or municipalities which were established. You know what? I got to add to this because I've seen some stuff with my own eyes. That it, like Blackjack, Oklahoma, that is not a municipality. It's literally sandwiched right next door to Taft, Oklahoma. Now, Taft, Oklahoma has a municipal charter, but literally right next door to it, sandwiched right next door to it, is Blackjack, Oklahoma, and it's unincorporated. So these Freedom Towns could either be municipal. Most of them started out as, you know, some people buying a few acres of land. That's how most of these people, you know, started out. Anyway, all black towns are municipalities which were established by or for predominantly black African-American communities. Many of these municipalities were established or populated by freed slaves, either during or after the period of legal slavery in the United States in the 19th century. In Oklahoma, before the end of segregation, existed dozens of these communities, and Texas had more than Oklahoma. But we'll cover that another day. By many African-American migrants from the Southwest and found where they could establish municipalities on their own terms. Many of these places were essentially social experiments, and a lot of those what started out as a social experiment, because they wanted to get away from the lynching, they wanted to get away from the violence, they wanted to be free. Okay. And that's why I'm saying a lot of these, I would say all of these towns, all of these Freedmen's villages or Freedmen's towns, including the one that Priscilla Baltimore started or founded, it was social entrepreneurship. They wanted a community where they can live free and safe. They weren't looking at it from a profit standpoint, but it was still an enterprise nonetheless. But their mission was social in nature, not, you know, profit-driven. Like I said, we got this whole month we're covering, once again, it's Slave Entrepreneur Month here on It's My House. But these Freedmen's Towns, let me just tell you how prolific these places were. In Alabama, you had African Town and Hobson City. Those were two freedom villages or towns in those places. Arizona had Mobile and Randolph. And I didn't know nothing was in Arizona. Let me read up about that. I guess today it's known as Sonoran Valley, also known as Mobile, is a community of in the southern planning of Goodyear in Maricopa County, Arizona, where history. Okay, the history of it, Mobile, Arizona was founded in the 1930s as an area for African Americans to live, notably an African American woman of Mobile, Arizona, Rebecca Dallas, that's spelled D-A-L-L-I-S, taught at Casa Grande in 1939. Local lore has it that some of the early residents were African Americans from Mobile, Alabama. However, researchers have found that railroad companies referred to the area as Mobile almost a decade before the first permanent settlers were in the area in the 1920s. Okay, well, you know what, we're going to cover this on another day, but California had Allensworth, Canada had North Buxton in Ontario, Canada, Colorado had Deerfield, Colorado was just a ghost town now. Here in Florida, you had Eatonville, that's 45 minutes from me, and it's 6 miles outside of Orlando. That's an active town. Fort Moses, which was overtaken by Mother Nature. Freetown, I'm not familiar with that one here in Florida. Now, Rosewood, that's questionable. You had blacks that lived in Rosewood, but we had a, let me see if I can get her on here, historian Jenkins, who grew up there, to get the low on down on that. Illinois had Brooklyn, founded by Mother Priscilla Baltimore, Lakeview, New Philadelphia. You also had Hopkins. You also have Hopkins Park in Pembroke. Illinois had, there's a bunch of these places. North Carolina's got them, New York State, New Mexico, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Maryland, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, the state of Virginia. So there are quite a few of these social enterprises that their community project was, you know what, let's start our own town or village. And many of those places still stand today. So now we're going to make a movie about this type of stuff. We're going to have to make it. We cannot wait on Hollywood to make a movie, a biopic about Mother Priscilla Baltimore. All right. Somebody asked me this morning, because when I said we're going to do the whole month as Slave Entrepreneur Month, they asked me, is it that many? And I'm pretty sure we can do one a day, probably for the entire year. Not probably, definitely for the entire year. We're not going to do that. This month we're going to cover 20 in a row, one a day. But many of them were social entrepreneurs. And part of the legacy that somebody like a Priscilla Baltimore left behind was Brooklyn, Illinois. We'll be back in a few minutes. Out. right, today, well, this whole month on It's My House, it's Slave Entrepreneur Month. We'll be featuring predominantly, in many cases, people that started out life legally, their legal description, their legal identity, according to the government. They were slaves. But even though they were slavery, they were allowed to take part in the free enterprise capitalistic system here in what we call the United States. So many of these former slaves, they were slaves. Let me break it down this way. Put some order to this. Okay. This is what they didn't show you in Roots and 12 Years a Slave and all these other slave movies that come out. A good portion of the people that were legally classified as slaves were artisans. All right. Artisans are basically craftspeople. They make things. Some of the things that they made were brooms, mops, beds, furniture, carpenters, people that can work with steel, fences. Many were artisans. Although they were legally over slaves, and they had an arrangement to work for Master so-and-so or whatever. You know, many times a lot of these slaves were allowed to, all right, after you finished what you had to do for us here on the plantation, you're free to go out and do your thing. A lot of them had what we would call today side hustles. In some cases, the people that owned some of these slaves, who were mostly, many of them were artisans, that particular slave carried financially his family. They had a skill set of making things, whatever it might be. Some were seamstresses, tailors. They made clothes. They had a skill set where they brought in enough income to support the family. Not their family, but I'm talking about the slave owner, the master's family. You know what? Ooh. I'll be right back. I put something on the stove and I smell it burning.
What's up, everybody? This is Jay, and this video is about, is Tariq worth $2 million? Now, we all know that he's a damn fool and he deserves what he's getting, but is he worth $2 million? Before we do, let's hit that like button. I need to get 200 likes for this video, and if you haven't already, please subscribe and bang that bell. I'm trying to reach 20,000 subs by the end of the month. Let's get into it. Now, Tariq, we all know, is a damn fool. He doesn't listen to Ghost or Tasha, and he's been corrupted by Kanan and turned against his father by Kanan and Tasha, and now he thinks that he's a dope boy when all he is a dorm room dope boy. He doesn't know anything about real life situations. And so he tried to get over on Vincent and the Olive Garden dope boy crew, and he bought some baby aspirin and tried to pass it off as being some pills, ecstasy, or whatever the case. And no, that would not work. If anything, he would have been better off trying to cut it. But he's an idiot. He knows nothing about this. He thought because they look similar that Vincent wouldn't know anything. And yeah, maybe with the eye test he wouldn't know, but once they began to sell the merch, then people would complain saying that these were duds, that the strength was weak, it was nothing, and that ruined his business. not necessarily put him out of business, but made him look bad as if he was selling duds to people trying to take their money. And Tariq already got his face smashed in the ground like a puppy that pooped on the carpet in their living room. And so that wasn't enough for him to realize that these are not the people that he should be messing with. And he came back talking about he was a man of his word. And then he sold them a bag of bull crap, whereas he would have been better off telling them, hey, I don't have the weight. I wish I had it, whatever the case, but, you know, I'm not able to do it. I'm out. But instead, he's trying to get money and sell stuff. That's not it. And even Vincent pulled out a gun in front of his face and let him know, hey, don't mess with me. And even that wasn't a good enough warning for Tariq not to do it. He's such an idiot. And so now he's in big trouble, and they want $2 million or else they were gonna kill him. And my cousin Vinny, he don't give a rat's ass or a witch's titty how Ghost and Tommy come up with the money. And Tariq, he's such an idiot, he doesn't know that now what he's done has allowed Vincent to put the squeeze like toothpaste on Ghost, Tommy, and Tasha to come up with money to save his life once again. He almost had that happen when he was with Kanan and they was going to kidnap him. And then he had Proctor killed and put Proctor's daughter in the situation where she has no parents. And he think because he took her to cousin Benny's house that he did good. He had his whole apartment where he lived ruined thanks to what he did working with Tommy. He doesn't have any idea on how to think first before he causes actions, because if he did, he wouldn't have went on ahead and tried to pull that move with my cousin Vinny. And now he's sitting there looking stupid, but about to end up biting the bullet because he ended up trying to play and get over the wrong dude. These aren't the dorm room kids that you've been serving. And now the only good thing is that Tommy and Ghost are working together. Maybe.
Okay. For those of you that are interested in power. Yeah. I put a pot of water on the stove and man forgot about it until I smelled something. And the pot was completely empty. Anyway, but no disaster, no fires, no mishaps, no crack pots or nothing like that. So, and I wanted to do a hot water bottle. That's why I had it on there. I got one now. In any event, today's the whole month, February, typically known as Black History Month. Well, our version of it is Slave and Entrepreneur Month. So we'll be featuring mostly people started out life legally as slaves in the United States, but many of them became entrepreneur. Oh, matter of fact, practically all the ones that we'll be featuring this month will be turned. I mean, they went from slave to they became entrepreneurs. And through their entrepreneurship, they were able to get enough money to buy their freedom from their so-called slave master. And many of them turned that business that they started into a social, by today's terms, the way I'm looking at it, as a social enterprise. Okay. And the social enterprise that Mother Priscilla Baltimore did, matter of fact, out of the 50 states that exist, former slaves, for the most part, founded social enterprises in the form of towns or villages or settlements, whatever you want to call them, in 25 of the 50 states. So we're putting out stuff that, you know, that you typically don't hear during Black History Month. I mean, Black History Month, you typically hear Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, George Washington Carver, Booker T. Washington, then we'll throw in some Malcolm X, and maybe some Elijah Muhammad, and throw in, Marcus Garvey. That's what you typically hear. But here we're focusing on the slave entrepreneurs and the social enterprises, the social entrepreneurship people participated in. All right. So today, our one for the day is Mother Priscilla Baltimore. You can read more about her if you go online, and there might be a video about her on YouTube or someplace like that. And you know what? It would be. I'm not a filmmaker, but I know somebody who is. I know a couple of people. It'll be interesting if people can put together a biopic on a lot of these people. I think it would do a lot of good. So, and if you know of any interesting person who was born a slave, and it doesn't have to be just here in the United States. It can be, because this thing was going on throughout the entire Western Hemisphere. You had slave entrepreneurs that popped up in what is now called Central America, and throughout South America as well. Let us know, and we can get it on here. Just before I go to the phone lines here. Let's see, in trending topics, there's one of the policemen, the one that killed Dante Wright, I think she's up for sentencing today. And Tom Brady retired. Let's see. The Washington football team, I think they're going to announce their new name this week. I don't know Whoopi Goldberg said something about the Holocaust, so. Let's see what she said. Oh, wait a minute. Whoopi Goldberg apologizes for saying the Holocaust was not about race. She says she's sorry for the hurt that she's caused. All right, hold on. Let me read about this. I don't know if they're going to make her take back her Goldberg card. Anyway, Whoopi Goldberg apologized Monday night for the comments she made on The View earlier in the day about the Holocaust, saying that she was sorry for the hurt she's caused. Goldberg, who had drawn wide criticism for the remarks that she made during the show's panel's Hot Topics discussion, as the host began discussing the banning of the graphic novel Moss, M-A-U-S, which tells the story of the author Art Spiegelman's father and his experience in the German concentration camps, with Jews depicted as mice and the Nazis as cats. Let's be truthful about it, because the Holocaust isn't about race. It's not about race, she said. It's about a man's inhumanity to man. That's what it's about. I understand what Whoopi was saying. But you know what? In this country, and I don't want to drift too far off of the, I already drifted off. Too late. We're very tribal in this country. So if you don't belong to a particular tribe, they don't like anybody outside their tribe saying anything. It's on Yahoo News. You can read it for yourself. In any event, okay, so we're going to go to the phone lines here. But, yeah, slave entrepreneurs. So if you know of anybody that you might want to hear covered here on Slave Entrepreneur Month, which is February, and I'm sure you can take back a little bit of trivia or content, but, you know, and it might be good conversation at wherever social events you're going to go to. But Mother Priscilla Baltimore, social entrepreneur, slave entrepreneur, and tomorrow we'll come up, we'll have another one. 314 area code, your mic is open.
Well, hello, LA, how are you?
I can't complain. I'm sitting here with a hot water bottle in one hand trying to get warm in Florida,
well,
of all places. You know what? We got a propane heat here, but we haven't used it in over 10 years. Because it doesn't get cold that often.
You don't have
no
fireplace?
No fireplace here. No, not in this house.
You know,
I'm good with this though. I throw in an extra T-shirt or two, put on some long johns, and get me a hot water bottle, and I'm good.
You know, I was listening to your a lot of the information about Brooklyn. Is not accurate.
Okay, what's your take on it?
Well, they made reference about the railroad pass in Brooklyn. Ain't no railroad pass, Brooklyn. The railroad junction is right across the road, right across Route 3 from Brooklyn, going back to the river. You're switching yards there galore. So whoever wrote that, it was just writing, making it sound like it's another instance where progress passes by a black town. You know, another thing, too, that was Indian land. Because that land is very close to the vicinity of the mounds, the Indian mounds, that's there in Cahokia. Very close. And until they put that levee in there, the Mississippi River, when it left its banks, it used to flood that area, especially over by the railroad. I have cousins that live in Venice, which is not far from there, right along Route 3. And you got the stockyards, which is going back toward Highway 55 overpass, which that same road, Route 3, takes you on into, after you do a little right turn, goes on into East St. Louis. So a lot of the information that they said wasn't really accurate.
Well, it is Wikipedia, and anybody can write up on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
I believe.
And it's right across the river from St. Louis. I know Brooklyn. Most of the business there is strip clubs. Have been for a long time. And those churches, those two church buildings that they talk about are probably still there. But overall,
that's a nice combination, strip clubs and churches.
Yeah, well, that's the only thing that they got in that area. But overall, that's that was Indian land. And you know the word, you get that information I sent you? I emailed you about Tubman.
All right, hold it. Wait a minute. I've got to find my phone here. Let me go to
the email.
Okay.
Yeah, I have it. Harriet Tubman was a very prosperous person.
She was. She was.
Yeah, she was. She, after she lost her second husband in a fight, and she found out that she was supposed to have been sold, her and her daughter, I don't forget how many kids she had. But she left Maryland and headed to Auburn, New York, where she purchased a lot of land and farmed and produced masonry. She had a production going on that was producing masonry, i.e. bricks.
Mm-hmm.
And she ran a multi-purpose boarding home, which burned
down.
Now,
I knew about the boarding house. I didn't know it was multi-purpose.
Yeah, it was also a hall, eating mm-hmm. place, too. And she replaced it with one built with modern material. She was in agriculture. And also, she had livestock where she produced dairy products.
See, that everything you're saying, that's
why. She had fruit artists.
See, you're bringing up stuff that they typically don't bring out about Harriet Tubman.
Right. She had fruit orchards.
Mm-hmm.
And she received a military, she received a pension because she worked for, she scouted for the Union forces. And her husband, Nelson Davis, also served in the Union forces. And when he died, she received his pension.
Yeah, I'm reading it right now. Her second husband,
Harriet,
Nelson Davis.
Was he related to you?
I don't know.
Yeah.
All I know was my dad came from Arkansas.
Yeah, so, L.A., what I'm saying is that the woman was very, she was middle class and up on there. She had it going on better than probably 80 or 90% of whites in the country at that time. But yeah,
I'm glad you brought that up. I'm just tired of the victim stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm
gonna tell you something else. This word slave, as it is used in the United States, is deceiving. Very deceiving.
I agree.
Because every black person practically was called a slave, the word slave. And if you look in other societies, for instance, like in West Africa, there's about five different categories of what you would call slaves.
Mm-hmm.
You had the servants. You had the pawn. You had the slave per se. You had war captives. And then you had the slave that was under what you call capital punishment. Now, if you go back to the origin where it came from, I mean, slavery was introduced to the world by through Africans.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had some civilizations.
Well, now, what did they call it, though?
They call it slaves. If you was a pawn, say you was a pawn, that means that you owe somebody some money.
Mm-hmm.
So you would give up a family member, well, hold my family member until I come up with your money, whatever it was. Probably was cowrie shell at the time.
All right. Yeah, because I got a feeling that the vocab, the language that they use, we're using, we call anything, like, if we don't think a person's getting a wage or whatever, they call it slave labor or child labor, all this. But what was the terminology that they used back then?
Well, it's got different words, man. It depends on what sect you was from. Like
right.
In my wife's, the Sabula, it means slave.
Mm-hmm.
The Akan had many different words for it. the word slave. I know in the Akan, the word is Bobami. Bobagmi. And, you know, you had different groups there. You the Bango, they had the, they called it another thing, and I can't name all those things. The Kluwisi was also in the Jerry, Akjeri. Yeri is a man, Akjeri is a female, so the name had different names. But the thing that I'm saying is that it's used out of misconceived here in the United States, the way the word is used. It was a person. Many, you had free labor and you had slaves.
Right.
You may mention a freeman. Freeman was those that was held by Indians that when the United States government paid Indians to let their property go, they became freemen, which could have been a freeman.
Okay, that's a very important distinction.
Yes. Freeman wouldn't have been applied to the 1865 slaves. Totally. So it's how they use the word, and the word is used kind of deceiving because what you visualize. But you see the black person that came along, they and if they was held as property, in the case like we made mention with West Africa, for whatever reason, if you was a war captive is the worst position to be because if you didn't pay restitution, you're going to be sold off. In some cases, you'd be killed.
Mm.
And that's why come those that were sold off that ended up in America who descended today, those descendants owe their restitution that their ancestors created and caused it, where they came from. They use the old cliche, the sins of the father follow the son. And in some families, you was cursed, generational curses.
Well, some think that might exist today.
Yeah, curses follow you today. It's only a particular way that you can remove a curse according to their culture and society.
Mm.
So, and you know the thing too, people didn't get rid of things that they didn't want. And just like it is today, if you have something that you want to sell, what do? You paint it, you shine it up, make it look presentable for those who may potentially want to buy it. Well, that's the same way they did with their captives, their wars. The people that they wanted to pass on to somebody else. They oiled them down, got them shiny. They put, I think it was sulfur, they put it on their private areas in order to kill lice and so forth. But I'm not sure. Well, I've seen this stuff. It's kind of like a white powder. And then people that was buying them, what did they do when they was buying one? They inspected it, right? They looked at their teeth, because looking at their teeth could better, one could tell the approximate age of an individual. It's like it is when you go to buy a used car. You kick the tires, you pull the oil dipstick out and smell it. You look at the wear of the tires, make sure the turn signals work. Get a feel for the brake pedal. Check how the transmission is shifting. So that's the same way they did in many cases with people. In slave markets, it was where you went and bought people. Just like you go to buy what? A used car.
Right. And I imagine some of these, particularly with the women, not all the women, but some of the women, were de facto some of your first mail order brides?
Well, I guess you could look at it like that.
Yeah. And they did produce
kids. And those
kids.
Activities have been going on for thousands of years. In West Africa, it was going on before They somebody with white skin, which in this case historically would have been the Portuguese. You know, Ghanaians held Portuguese slaves too.
I believe it.
It's recorded that they did it. You came into the country.
They stumbled upon something that it, you know.
No, it was a punishment. It was a way of being punished. They would hold you. You came into the country, and you done something that was illegal, as you want to say. Just like if you come in, get drunk, shoot up the place, whatever, they put your ass into a confinement. Quote unquote slaves. You done something to a particular family, you're gonna be a slave in that family until it was paid off. Mm-hmm. That's why you was considered property. You look up at the definition, you was a property slob of somebody else. How else was you going to cover the cost for the expenses that you created?
Right.
I mean, think about it.
Well, makes
sense. It's like when people say that, like they use the title that we built the country. Well, that's not true. People worked for folks in areas like agriculture, but everybody didn't have the skills to be no artisan. As it is today, everybody don't have that.
No.
They wasn't working with, you made mention that they was working with, they wasn't working with steel, they were working with iron. And iron was acquired through trade with European countries, like the Portuguese, and they was trading for products, corn, gold in particular. Gold was a commodity that was used by European artisans that made the, I can't think of the name.
That's one topic I've never heard discussed during Black History, but, you know, I'm not in everybody's Black History class, but, you know, Black artisans, that topic, I'm sure somebody's discussed it, I just haven't heard it.
You ever seen a piece of work it has gold inlays on it, like a gun, a weapon, a sword.
Mm-hmm.
And they inlay it onto a metal that's been properly,
right.
The surface has been prepared. And, you know, gold can be beaten into a fine leaf, very, very thin. Then they can inlay it onto these items. Well, that's what gold was used for. It was used for that type of artistic value back in those days. And it was just something else. So that's what its purpose for. And of course, it made gold coins, gold nuggets. They use a process to smelt it.
Mm-hmm.
With bellows. They use a process of smelting iron or heating it with charred wood. And by accidental happening, some of the carbon from the charred wood would intermix with the iron, molten iron, and you would create steel unknowingly.
I understand some of these plantations back then had their own schools to train, you know, the people right there on the plantation, you know, to do certain jobs.
Yeah, it was basically, it was labor. In agriculture, even in those countries there, you need labor in order to accomplish an agriculture venture. They didn't have no tractors.
Right.
And they had, on their own, they had either wooden or stone tools. They didn't have no iron. They would incorporate animals, oxen, in some cases. Your hoe was either fashioned from the trunk of a tree, and they made provisions on the hoe for putting an insert that was a stone to cut your furrows.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they was used. And they got paid, and what you call slaves are the workers, they got paid.
Exactly. That's how Baltimore and a lot of other people were able to buy their freedom and buy that of some of their family members and buy land, buy the acre.
Yeah, blacks that worked on the railroad got paid. If you think about it, if they wasn't going to get paid, would they stay there doing it?
No.
Right. When you use...
Yeah.
When you use, just think about this. See, people don't use no common sense. If you got a plantation and you have bought property in the form of what you call a slave or a worker, if you ain't treating them right and paying them right, what they going to do?
Leave.
They're going to leave. Now, what do you have to prevent that? You have to have a security in the form of slave catchers. And they ain't working for nothing.
Yeah, you got to pay them.
People don't think you got to pay them.
Mm-hmm.
If not, when they went after and caught a runaway and brought him back, what they do, here you go, sir, thank you. Hell no, you paid them. And that was an expense that had to be covered by the operation that you had going on. In this case, agriculture.
Right.
And all agriculture wasn't profitable. Some of the most laborious agriculture was probably sugarcane in making it, because you required a lot of energy in order to boil the pulp. You ever had the sugarcane juice?
Yeah, when I was young, my great-grandmother, we still got that land in the family. We ain't doing nothing with it, though. 88 acres, and you can sugarcane for as far as the eye could see on that place.
See, sugarcane is a process. Now, you can take a piece of sugarcane, a length, and run it through a press to extract juices out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to consume the juices within a very, very short time. If not, it would go bad on you. It goes bad quick. Matter of fact, it can go bad overnight and turn to vinegar.
Mm.
So they would process the sugarcane, produce steam in order to turn it into a powder. They use sulfur in order to make it turn white. That's why sulfur is a commodity, too. It's a chemical action.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Now, sugarcane don't grow every place. It's more prominent in the Caribbean. That's why all the people that were brought out of West Africa to be brought to the Western Hemisphere, only 5% of them came to what you call the United States. The rest of them went down into the Caribbean. And
yeah, I know
America.
Barbados, they do sugarcane there. Not on my family's.
Because the climate is conducive to the crop.
Mm-hmm.
That's why come Europe didn't have no slaves. Europe only got probably one growing season because of their latitude and the climate in the country. In America, you can have at least two growing seasons. In Africa, you grow all the damn time.
Right.
They're 3 degrees off, for instance, in Ghana, they're 3 degrees north of the equator. And their longitude is cool. that really don't make no difference, the latitude that comes into play. So that's where they grew food. The Europeans went down and established a network with growers in those countries. They set up their trading posts on the shores.
Mm-hmm.
Because you go from the shore to the ship and to the transportation going back to your country. And when settlers came here, they had to clear. You know, it's hard to imagine you look out today on your city landscape. At one point in time, there was nothing but forest. Like Central Park is in New York. It was all forest. So they had to have the clearing to remove trees and underbrush and everything else. So
that's
they got
some hard work.
Yeah, they got laborers to do it. Slave labor.
Mm-hmm.
They had to drain areas, reroute streams and so on. So they used laborers for that. Today they do it with excavation equipment.
I know this is right where I'm at.
That wasn't built in America. It was just providing labor.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wasn't treated right, guess what? They escape, run away. And it happened today on job. If my employees wasn't getting paid right, they wouldn't come to work.
You're right.
People don't think. They fall for any cock and bull story.
Well, owning a slave was that's a major investment. So it doesn't make sense.
Nice.
Right. You're not going to abuse. No. They have to produce for you. You just can't beat them to death and then, expect
right.
them to produce for you.
You got a good point. I mean, it's obvious. Common sense. If you got some people working in the field, and you came out there pissed off and started beating them, what you think they going to do?
Right.
It's like people
I mean, if anything,
I want to
make sure they're well-fed. I'm going to make sure they're well-fed. And you got, if you didn't have somebody, they're in good metal, good health conditions. Because they got to produce.
Absolutely. What did during World War II when Walter Chrysler, of Chrysler Motors,
mm-hmm.
he was a major, if it wouldn't have been for him and his innovation, United States probably would have been in bad shape during World War II. But one of the things that he came up with in order to secure good workers was employee-provided medical. He provided his workers with medical care. And that way he was able to pull workers from other companies like GM and Ford.
Right.
Now, so you got to treat your workers right.
Now, let's bring this into 2022 here. I think a lot of American workers, not all, I don't know what the percentage is, but I think some of these American workers today, they want a lot more than what they're worth.
Well, anybody do. That's just human nature. People are always going to want more than what they're worth because they can acquire what they're working for sooner.
Man, well,
unless they go out and sell it.
Man, do that.
Yeah, that's just human nature. It's been with man all the time. You know, in West Africa, they used to have a medium called cowrie shells that they traded with.
Mm-hmm.
And you go along the beach and just pick them up after they wash up on shore. And that's what the trade was. And that was the medium that they paid for their trade activities.
Okay.
For a long time. Then they found a use in they didn't have no use for gold. Others that had a use for gold. Same thing with diamonds. They didn't have no damn use for diamonds. For what? It was others who had a use for diamonds. And they set the value on it.
Right.
What are you going to use gold for? In Egypt, they used gold to encapsulate a lot of monuments. The Tekenus, or what you call the obelisk, it would beat gold after they smelted it. They would beat it to a very, very thin. So you can take a piece of gold that you can hold in your hand, and you can thin that out, what they call annulling. You can annul it to where it stretch clean across the town. It won't break. It's just that pliable. So this is what they were using it for. They would annul it and use it to cover the tips of their monuments. And when the sun glanced off of it, you could see it for miles.
Well, you're right about gold. I know some people value it, but I've never had to use it yet.
Well, I used to mine it in Ghana.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's pretty late. Now, that's labor intensive. Well, you got machines now, though.
Yeah, it was mining for $252 an ounce with people and so on. They got many different ways to do it. You can do it chemically. You can do it with a process that's called precipitation. I used to buy gold in the city. I advertised that I buy your gold rings, watches, and so forth, and set up a location. People come and bring it. I weigh it and give them the X number of dollars per gram, like $350 a gram or something like that. I forget what it was. Because I used to process it at home using electrolysis process to pull it out of whatever it was on or whatever it was. If it was solid, we turn it into a powder. Go through a process of drying that powder out. Had chemicals to check and see if it was clean, if they turned a certain color. Then put it in an oven that reached the temperature about 3,500 degrees Fahrenheit, smelt it, and you would have 24.9999. You never can get, I'm sorry, you have 23.99. You never can get 24. It's just something you can't reach. So that precip process is probably, you can do that on your kitchen table until the time came for you to use what's called a storm. You add this chemical that causes it to drop out of solution down to the bottom. Then you pull the liquid off. You don't throw the liquid away because the liquid has other chemicals in it like silver, platinum. And palladium.
Yeah, platinum. Mm-hmm.
You pull the silver out with aluminum foil. The aluminum foil and the silver come right out. Then you do another process, take the platinum out. Then another process to take the palladium, P-A-L-L-I-U-M-I-N. Palladium. Gold comes out first because it has the highest specific gravity. On the element table, it's very heavy. Take your piece of juicy fruit gum, take it out of the aluminum, the foil, and use that to pull the silver out.
Well, perception.
There's platinum in catalytic converter. That's why you have idiots going around with cordless saws, getting on the car, cutting out the catalytic converter. Because it has a tendency, when heated hot, it attracts the elements that's in the ignition to keep it from going out into the air. So when you go to the muffler shop and you buy a catalytic converter, they keep the old one because they get the platinum out.
Interesting. And most people don't know that.
Mm-mm.
And they just, what's the bill? What's the damage? And pay for it.
It's like the black man, I can't think of his name, was making chemicals or something else. He was making gunpowder for the North and the South. He was using ammonia nitrate, sulfur, and carbon, mixed in a proper solution, a combination, produce gunpowder called saltpeter.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, you've heard of the word saltpeter.
Mm-hmm. I first heard it when I was in sixth grade. And I guess it was an urban myth back then.
What grade you say? What grade did you say?
Sixth grade.
Well, see, that's what I argue all the time. Half the stuff that I hear people running from, afraid of today, we learned about that stuff when we were in elementary school. That's why I ain't scared of no damn COVID-19. That's why you see people running around with masks over their face, their nose, and mouth. They ain't doing no damn good. The damn virus is on your skin, and it'll walk over to your eyes and go behind your eye to get to your nasal passage. People in America have done
it that way before.
Well, yeah, have you ever heard of an eye, nose, and throat? Doctors.
Yeah, ear, nose, and throat.
They're all connected. Yeah. Your biggest immune element of your immune system is your skin. Viruses ain't going to go through the skin unless it's something new. And, I mean, you can poison yourself through going through your epidemiology, but viruses is usually going to get into your nasal. They don't draw blood to check for COVID. It's a pulmonary disease issue. So they can check for its presence in your nasal passages. But the way they do it is flawed because you got viruses in your damn nose. That's dead because they've been trapped in your snot. That's why your snot turns hard boogers. All them damn viruses and bacteria that accumulate dead. It gets hard and turns to hard boogers that you've been, as a kid, you ate.
Yeah. Well, yeah, people have done, kids do that.
Same thing in your eyes. Your eyes tear, and that solution is very deadly to things that's trying to get into you. That's why in the morning you wake up, you got that crust in the corner of your eyes where it has been pushing it out. It's dead stuff.
Man, the human body's something else.
Same thing with your mouth. That's why I come a human being compared to an animal. You ever see an animal lick its sores, its wounds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They can do it because their saliva is alkaline. What happens when you do it? How does it feel? If you got a cut and you put your finger in your mouth, how does it feel? It burns because your saliva is acidity, designed to kill stuff. But you got some bacteria that can live in an acid environment. That's why your breath stinks. Your breath stinks because bacteria desiccate because it's alive. It eats stuff. Yeah. I mean, what is so hard to understand that
Well, people run on emotions, and they don't research, do their think or anything like that.
Yeah, we live in some dangerous times, really.
Well, yeah, with all this cancel culture and...
They had a lady that was in New York. You know, they had a big funeral for all two officers that got killed. And maybe it was one.
Yeah, I've been reading about that.
Riviera was one.
Yeah.
But,
and then he was like 22 years old. He was a young guy.
Yeah, they blocked off the street because they had about 30,000 officers out there. All right. There's a lady that was working for a film company. And she made the comment about them blocking off the streets. Said it was ridiculous. So somebody had a heart attack. Well, it went viral. And then up comes the film company, fires her, saying that we can't have somebody like that who's this so insensitive. Well, a woman got the right to say whatever the hell she want to say in this country. She should sue them. And it does make sense. Suppose somebody, even in the funeral, had a heart attack. Let alone in one of the residences along the streets where that was blocked off and where the people had congregated for the funeral, police officers, a sea of them. So things are so jacked up nowadays.
That's true. Oh,
if you don't fight.
Do you hear about Trump's, they're going to launch it President's Day?
Yeah,
his new social media platform?
Yeah, I've contributed to it and going to it.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Facebook and them has got completely crazy. You can post a National Geographic picture of a tribal group. And the kids may be naked. And they want to say it goes against their community standards. So, you know, you don't argue with people like that. You just leave them alone.
Right.
You leave them alone. I mean,
right.
Ain't porn.
Well, That's true.
So getting back to the substance about slave entrepreneur, you're absolutely right. You had, there was people that was labeled slave. The word slave is being taken out of concept as it originally stood for. There was different kinds of people in that position. Like I may mention, in some societies you had at least five or six categories, pawn, prisoners of war, servants, slave. It was just the name. Here comes a black person down the street. You don't know the name. They associate and say, here comes a slave. You might be a free slave. You've heard that term before, haven't you?
Right. I have.
And to say that getting good pay don't make no sense because, as you may mention earlier about the one lady about Baltimore,
She bought the freedom of other family members.
Was it like what? Buying property. Like going to
a garage. I'm glad you put it that way. Because you're right. If it's less like you're buying a car or a piece of land or a house or whatever.
Or a coat.
You're right.
Absolutely. Property. And
it
you can't
proper.
Blame nobody because it was a practice that had been going on since time immemorial.
Well, today, using sports, you know, those owners, you know, trade, you know, buy, you know, I'll buy that contract or buy out that contract, trade this person, trade that person. So
yeah, until the free agency clause, but Kurt Floyd filed a lawsuit. A baseball player couldn't go where he wanted to go. They had to be, what, traded off. of something of value. You either gonna pay another team, because when your Negro League, those teams, those black teams would buy a player from one another. I think maybe Willie Mays was even sold. I'm not sure with him. But they were sold. Hey, look, I give you $800 for that shortstop, so on, so on, so on. And that's the way they took on the contract of the other player.
Right.
They do that today.
You're absolutely right. Nobody whines and complains about it.
And draft picks, right?
Right.
And draft picks, the teams that come
later. You got kids and their parents looking forward to draft day.
Oh, hell yeah. Like I told you, my nephew is the nation's number one college pick. Right now, he's at Missouri. And you know, funny thing too, Missouri, what's their team name? Tigers. Well, the Tigers, that name came from a Confederate unit.
Is that Mizzou?
Missouri and Kansas, huh?
Okay. No, is that Mizzou?
Mizzou, yes. Mizzou
the nickname
Tigers.
Of, yeah. Okay.
That's a Confederate name. So you say the Washington Redskins are getting ready to change their team name from Redskins. Well, hell, if you started that, you never would stop.
Mm-hmm.
If you started changing the names of entities, you never would stop. That's the most ridiculous mess I ever heard. Why don't you just make a donation or set up a scholarship fund for Indy? They'd rather have that. It's cheaper for you to change the name, though. So ignorance is bliss nowadays, L.A.
Right.
It's just total bliss. And you hear black folks.
Anyway, Bianchi, I'm going to sign off here for the day.
All
thanks
right.
for the information. Have a good day, everybody. See you guys tomorrow.